Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, Pinal County Sheriff on the new Netflix show profiling a new strategy in one of his jails.
And we'll meet a group of left-curious right-wingers.
But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
Isn't this the height of hypocrisy? Pete Hegseth says something in 2016 specifically about Donald Trump. I sense something generically about you must follow the law, the Uniform Code of Military Justice. His case, it seems to be fine. My case, the president wanted me hanged, executed, prosecuted, and now they want to demote me.
Since you're not reading the letters and the refusals that we've already sent you, I will say it to you directly, Mr. Jesus Olcete at the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. Again, sir, pound sand.
We wish Gilbert resident Jay Seeley well in this campaign, but from our perspective, nothing's changed. We are extremely confident Gina Silveto will be the Republican nominee in Arizona 1.
It shouldn't be viewed as a typical American adventurism type of issue. What we're doing is we're enforcing the law from a guy who was the head of a cartel that was coming after the U.S.
Our intention, at least to start, is to send up conformity so that everybody, small businesses included, can file their taxes more quickly.
And with me to talk about the DOJ suing Arizona Secretary of State, another presidential endorsement in an Arizona congressional primary, and more are Lorna Romero-Ferguson of Elevate Strategies. Lorna, good morning.
Good morning.
And former state lawmaker, former chair of the Arizona Democratic Party, Raquel Turan. Raquel, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So let's start with the Department of Justice, Raquel, which is suing Secretary of State Adrian Fontes. I guess in some ways, maybe not such a surprise. They've done this in other states. Fontes has said repeatedly he's not going to turn over this information. I'm curious, like, he is obviously up for election this year. How does this roll into that?
Well, I think he's doing the right thing, and he's very direct. I heard him say, take me to jail if you need to, because what he's doing right now is making sure that we are protecting all the information of the voters of Arizona, the Social Security numbers. Even though some information is already public, but certain information has to remain confidential. And he is following the law. He's following the state law, and he's following federal law. And frankly, in my opinion, this is just to try to foment that there is voter fraud, and we already know it's non-existent.
Lorna, do you think Fontes is doing the right thing here? With the stipulation that I don't think any of the three of us are lawyers.
Yeah, for full disclosure, not an attorney here. But we've talked about it previously on the show when the DOJ made that initial request and Fontes said pound sand back then before this lawsuit. The context of which this is all coming from is very important, as Raquel just noted on. This is all in the context of what happened in the 2020 election and the fraud that they claim and that people still are talking about and claiming that there was fraud, which has been made abundantly clear that there was no fraud, especially in Arizona. So in a state like Arizona, where Secretary Fontes has this duty to oversee this very important, sensitive, confidential information and what we've been through for the past 6 years, it makes sense that he's pushing back. Why do you want this information? What are you going to do with it? What are the intentions? Yes, take me to court and we'll try to figure this out. But I mean, if the DOJ and the Trump administration just wants this information to further claim that, you know, he wrongfully lost the 2020 election and or to foment going into 2026 any potential fraud in Arizona, which we know is not that's just not true. That is not helpful for our democratic system in general. And so he is doing the right thing. He has to protect this voter information. And we need to get to a point where we've moved on from 2020, even 2022, yeah. You know, with Carrie Lake and some others, and just focus on how do we restore trust in our election system and just move forward so we can have a successful 2026 election.
Yeah. And he needs to continue going. He needs to continue the efforts to protect the voters of Arizona. And I think it really is a reminder that Donald Trump and his administration do not run our elections. It's the Secretary of State, and I'm looking forward to him continuing the stance.
Raquel, do you think this will play a role in the campaign? He's going against the Republican presumed nominee. I don't think there's anyone else in that primary right now. Alexander Kaledin, who is an election skeptic, I think is maybe the way to say it. Does this issue play a role in that campaign?
I mean, it's unfortunately it becomes so political. The Secretary of State should not be this political. This race should be about who will administer our elections and making sure that they're administered correctly and that voters are protected and that their votes count. And when you have these type of issues, yeah, they become political, but it helps them be in the forefront protecting the voters of Arizona. That is what he has said from his first campaign. And I remember his slogan, protecting our democracy or protecting our republic's democracy. That's what he used to say, and that's what he will continue to say. And it puts him in a position where he can demonstrate that that is what he is doing.
Lorna, does this help him? I mean, we've talked on the show before about how Arizona voters broadly, when you take it out of, example, the GOP primary, tend to not be super enamored of election conspiracy theories mm-hmm. and election yeah. denialism. Does this help him going for reelection?
Potentially. I mean, it's really hard to say January 2026, you know, what it's going to look like in, sure. in the general. Yeah. But it is going to be a campaign issue. And it's a high profile issue that we're talking about it now. And the mm-hmm. media is going to continue to talk about it. So the days of the Secretary of State race being a snooze fest like it was 10 years ago is no longer the case, because we are talking about election integrity, potential fraud, et cetera. So obviously the Trump administration is making this a major issue. We know the Republicans who are going to be running against, it's most likely Kaledin, is going to make it an issue. So it remains to be seen how voters are going to fluctuate going up to this election cycle, because, I mean, in Arizona, we've been talking about potential fraud for so long, right? I'm not sure if that's going to be the lead issue on voters' mind with the economy and other things going on. But, yeah, it could potentially help him depending on Trump's favorability and everything else that's going on with the Trump administration.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe this is not necessarily tied into it, but voters in Arizona trust our process. The fact that more than 90% of voters receive their early ballot at home, their ballots at home, shows that they believe in this process. So I think that the good thing is that we know that voters don't believe that there is that kind of fraud happening here in Arizona.
Raquel, let me stick with you on another story of the federal government going after an Arizona politician. This week, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth formally started the process of he censured Senator Mark Kelly. He started the process of trying to demote him from his military rank, which would affect the pension he has. Again, this is not necessarily a surprise. This move has sort of been telegraphed. Yeah. But I'm curious, like, what you make of Kelly's response to all of this. He's been pretty defiant.
He has been defiant, and he is meeting the moment. This is Mark Kelly's moment, and I think, like, he has always been a hero. I mean, the fact that he has been in combat, he's been a veteran, and he says in his statements have said it all. No, I've fought for our country, and that includes making sure that we're protecting our Constitution, we're protecting our First Amendment right, and he has been responding for himself, but at the same time, I think that the way that he has responded shows to service members that he has their back and that he doesn't want this to trickle and that the silence could trickle to other service members. So, in my opinion, Senator Mark Kelly is really fighting back in a way that sends a message that this has to stop with him and it cannot continue.
Lorna, what do you make of the way that Kelly has been responding to this? I mean, he's been everywhere. He was on The Daily Show this week. He was on NPR this week on Morning Edition. He's been on a lot of the cable networks. Like, he's talking about this a lot.
Yeah, he's really seizing the moment and the opportunity, which it's not surprising. I mean, you're being personally attacked, something that is very dear and important to him is his service to this nation, right? And it's become a very political issue for the Trump administration. It's not like they're just kind of going after him. They're being very public and vocal about this. So, of course, he's going to do the same in his defense. Right. I do think that it's probably just a waste of time from the Trump administration, in all honesty. Senator Mark Kelly should not be surprised by the criticism that he's being that's being received by the Trump administration. Anybody who speaks out against them, they come out in force against, Republican or Democrat, right? But I think he knew going into this that he was going to potentially have a target on his back, right? Filming that video, being in a high profile ranking that he is in the military, all of the service that he's had, being a U.S. senator in a state like Arizona, a swing state, that they were going to go after him. And so, unfortunately, and mind you, again, I'm not an attorney, so I don't know the nuances of if he actually violated any kind of uniform code of military conduct or whatnot. Sure. But it just seems like there's a lot going on that the Secretary of Defense should be focusing on. And the fact that so much time and energy is being put on Mark Kelly is just giving him more popularity and more opportunities to talk to the media and build his name ID nationally than he a few months ago.
Well, so let me ask you about that, because there's been a lot of discussion on social media, noted bastion of deep intellectual thinking, that, you know, all this is really doing is elevating Mark Kelly leading into the 2028 presidential election. Mm-hmm. Of course, his name has been out there. He was apparently, shortlisted for vice president when Kamala Harris was running last year or 2 years ago now. So, I mean, do you see this as sort of an elevation of Mark Kelly nationally?
100%. I mean, like you were just saying, he's on all these national programs. You see the fundraising emails all the time. Like, his team is capitalizing on it, which no criticism to them. Anybody would, right, in this situation. So, yes, they are elevating his profile nationally. That might be intentional because they're hoping to just kind of like, you know, harm his reputation should he choose to run in 2028, what he intends to do in the future. But also they want to, you know, restore Republican leadership in the state when it comes to the U.S. Senate. Right. So from the Trump administration, they're probably looking at it as we want to damage his reputation as much as possible, leading into whatever direction he chooses to go in, whether that's, again, running for U.S. Senate or nationally. And obviously he's not cowering to that. And he is taking the opportunity to build his network, increase his name ID, fundraise, et cetera, beyond those people who already knew who Senator Mark Kelly was, whether it was from gun control, you know, advocates or just from his military service or you know, being an astronaut. You know, some people just followed that. So he's really broadened his name ID to a new audience.
Raquel, do you think this is elevating him?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think like what he is showing is that he is somebody that can fight back. Right. Because Mark Kelly, I mean, his story from being the husband of Gabby Giffords and being by her side every single step of the way, being an astronaut, being in the military, everything. But people know him as the good guy. And then Arizona is a unique place to campaign. And his story was just it connected with so many Arizonans. And the fact that people across the country are getting to see the way that he can fight back for Arizona and for everybody, for that matter, I think it's really, really good for him. And I'll just end like, you know, Kamala Harris, she did write in her book that Mark Kelly had not had his moment. And I think this is his moment. Hmm. So that's interesting to see what happens in the presidential primaries.
Interesting.
For the Democratic
All right, party. Let's take a break very quickly. That is Raquel Turan. I'm also joined by Lorna Romero Ferguson. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guest this week, former state lawmaker, former state party Democratic Party Chair Raquel Turan and Lorna Romero Ferguson with Elevate Strategies. Lorna, let me start with you on the first congressional district. This is the seat that David Schweikert will be leaving as he runs for governor now. Kind of a swingish type district as far as competitive districts in Arizona go. It's a competitive primary. Gina Swoboda, the chair of the state Republican Party, announced he's running. Joseph Chaplick, a state representative, has announced he's running. Jay Feely, former NFL player with the Cardinals and other teams, has announced he is running. And now President Trump had endorsed Swoboda, has now also endorsed Jay Feely. This is obviously not something that Trump is not known to do. He's endorsed two candidates in the GOP gubernatorial primary. But I'm curious how you see, like, what kind of impact you see that having on that race?
You know, and we've talked about this in the context of the gubernatorial race with Biggs and Karen Taylor Robson both having the Trump endorsement, and it kind of just evens the playing field, right, for the candidates. Because in the past, you know, Trump would endorse one primary candidate and people were vying for that endorsement. Mm-hmm. And the person who got it, the general wisdom was in a primary, you're basically going to be the nominee because the Trump endorsement was that important. When it's shared, you know, it's everyone's going to say, I'm the Trump endorsed candidate, but it doesn't really move the needle as much when it's multiple people, right? So then it comes down to the actual campaign. A name ID, which Gina has some with, you know, people who follow Republican Party politics, you know, PCs and whatnot. Jay Feely probably has a little bit more given the fact that he's a former, you know, Arizona Cardinals football player. Even though he switched districts from the East Valley to this one, it's really going to come down to who runs a better campaign in that district, who can fundraise, who can build the infrastructure, because the Trump endorsement, like I said before, is just going to kind of level that playing field a little bit more. And it's a smart move by the Trump administration at this point because I think they're looking for as many wins as possible. So being able to kind of share the love in terms of endorsements.
Hedging his bets
a little bit. You know, so then he can say, oh, my endorsed candidate won the primary. And then they can just obviously fully support them in the general. But it's really going to be who runs the more effective campaign in that district that you said is very much on paper a swing district. Republican voters there tend to lead much more moderate. It's not typically the more MAGA crowd. So it'll be interesting to see what types of campaigns these folks run.
Raquel, we heard a little bit in the montage at the beginning of the newscap from a campaign consultant for Swoboda who referred to Jay Feely as Gilbert resident Jay Feely. Lorna referenced that he was in a different congressional district running in the Andy Biggs district. He, of course, is also running for governor. Does that matter? I mean, obviously, you don't have to live in the district to be a member of Congress. That's not a rule. But to voters, will that matter?
I think, first and foremost, Trump endorsements for everybody, please. As a former chair of the Arizona Democratic Party, we want everybody to get endorsed in primaries in a competitive seat. I think that is a gift for Democrats. I'm excited about that because this district has been – we've lost it. Democrats have lost this district by very, very little. And I think one of the reasons has been because there has been an incumbent. And now that it's an open seat, it's an opportunity for Democrats, even though right now there is a competitive primary with the Democratic Party as well. But the issues that Democrats are talking about, even in the primary, are about affordability, are about things that people care about. And the disaster that has happened with Donald Trump's administration all past year really helps us. So the more endorsements that the Republicans get from Donald Trump in that district, the better. But I think at the end of the day, you can make the case that somebody is not from the district, but it is about who knocks on doors, who reaches the voters, how your story will be compelling. And we've seen it in the past. Voters connect to what people say, to the values versus just facts.
Lorna, do you think a Trump endorsement, obviously, I would imagine it helps in the primary. Mm-hmm. Does it help in the general election in this district?
Probably not as much, given the makeup of that district. And if you look back to see how David Schweiker won the last few election cycles, everybody went into each election cycle saying this is the year Schweiker gets taken out by a Democrat and he wins, right? He threaded that needle beautifully, which I think someone needs to do a deep analysis on, of not upsetting the Trump administration, but not being a vocal cheerleader about them as well, right? And so whoever wins the primary, I mean, a lot of their messaging in the primary, like Raquel was just referencing, is going to be used against them in a general election,
100%,
right? And so they have to be careful, understanding that, yes, they need to be able to get, you know, that majority support to become the nominee. But how does that pivot and translate to the broader audience of CD1 for a general election, right? So it really is going to come down to how they run their races and how these individuals kind of thread that needle like Schweiker did, you know, in all honesty, to keep kind of the Trump supporters happy while also being able to appeal to the independents and the moderates in that district who are swing voters that we've seen in previous election cycles.
How difficult a needle is that to thread?
It is very difficult. That's what I'm saying. Someone needs to analyze how Schweiker – because, I mean, every – you look at it, Juan Ciscomani in his district, similar makeup, right? But for some reason, more attention gets put on Juan when it comes to Trump than Schweiker did in the past, right? How does that happen? You know, it's an interesting dynamic that we've seen, that some candidates get a lot more of that Trump pressure versus others, even though they're in equally similar situations when it comes to the competitiveness of their district.
Mm. All right. So, guys, just a few minutes left. I want to ask you about something. Usually we look back at the week. I want to ask you about something coming up next week. Of course, the state legislature coming back into session. Governor Hobbs on Monday will be giving her a State of the State speech. Raquel, you served in the legislature. I'm curious, like, how would you describe what you think this session is going to look like?
Oh, wow. Well, I think the conversation will be about affordability. We have seen that not only that it is a winning issue, but it's also what's on top of people's minds. So we are going to see, hopefully, my hope is that we see Democrats really, really closely with the governor to get the best budget possible. And also, I hope that we get to see the legislature address Proposition 123 on education.
That's a school funding initiative.
Yes, that has to be a top priority.
Lorna, what do you think this session is going to look like?
I think it's going to really come down to the state budget and finances, right? You have, obviously, we're not in the best financial situation in the state currently. And there's a number of things that are coming up that require significant costs on the state. So tax conformity is one of the big issues that obviously Governor Hobbs has talked about, and Republican leaders in terms of conforming to the One Big Beautiful Act bill, which contains a number of tax changes that Arizonans, families, middle class families, small businesses care about and want to make sure happen in 2026, right? But that's a decision made by the legislature. So that's one. We have obviously the ongoing question about education funding and Prop 123. Does that go back to the ballot to then remove that $300 million off the general fund? And then you have the impending kind of healthcare cost crisis that's going to come next year, when the full implementation of HR1 comes into effect and there's drastic cuts to Medicaid.
Right.
So does the legislature do some forward thinking on that, or do they punt until next year and say, well, we'll deal with it to see when we see the actual cuts happen to the state? And then you also have water, right? Big issue, big battle amongst a lot of these lower basin states right now when we're talking about Colorado River. But what is Arizona gonna do in terms of preparing for a drier future? What investments do we need to make? Everything costs money at this point, right? So how are those dollars going to get allocated? I think Republicans are going to be very strategic and make sure that their priorities are in alignment with what voters want in terms of, you know, like Raquel said, affordability, cost of living, et cetera. What can they do to make sure that Arizona voters are better positioned in 2026 than they were in 2025 when it comes from just a cost and cost of living standpoint?
All right, very quickly, just yes or no answer here. Will Governor Hobbs break her own veto record this year? Raquel,
100%.
Yeah, okay.
Yes. Oh, I agree. Yeah.
100%.
It'll be even more intense in an election year.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Something to look forward to for the year then. Yes. All right. Lorna Romero Ferguson, Raquel Teron, thanks to you both for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, an experiment in corrections is filmed for Netflix in Pinal County.
But first, on yesterday's show, I sat down with our senior producer, Nick Sanchez, and KJZZ political reporter Cameron Sanchez to debrief about what we saw at Turning Point USA's America Fest convention. Among other things, we wanted to understand the mindset of the high school and college students who join Turning Point chapters, because they are powering a dramatic rise in the cultural influence of extreme right-wing ideas. This phenomenon of young people shifting to the right politically was arguably one of the biggest storylines of last year. Unsurprisingly, one of the other major stories was the attempt by Democrats to get those voters back. And as you may recall, shortly before Christmas, we brought you an interview with a political organizer who has a plan to do just that. Z. Cohen Sanchez runs a group called National Ground Game, which envisions itself as, quote, the turning point of the left. During America Fest, National Ground Game put together an event with a name we cannot say here on the radio, but it rhymes with Unstuck America. The idea behind the event, Z told me, was to counter-program America Fest. At Marley's Bar, just down the street from the Turning Point event, she put together a group of left-wing influencers for a series of debates about hot-button issues. The goal was to entice some of the young people who were in town for America Fest to wander in and maybe get to know a new version of the left. So, did it work? Well, KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez was there, and after our conversation about America Fest, we sat down for a follow-up about what she saw at Unstuck America.
We're talking about a crowded bar, okay. So obviously not the scale of America Fest, which is taking up a chunk of the Phoenix Convention Center, thousands and thousands of people. In this case, we're talking about more like maybe 100 people, okay. As many as can fit in there. It's loud and definitely raunchier kind of environment, you know, where people are drinking and kind of yelling and being rowdy. And I think what was interesting to me off the bat was there were a lot of people there from Turning Point and from America Fest who were going to both of these events. And I was like, huh, I wonder what these people are thinking.
Okay, so this is extremely interesting to me because I was listening to some of the tape that you gathered from the Turning Point folks who were there. And it struck me that they are exactly the audience we might imagine that Zico and Sanchez and National Ground Game are looking to attract. At least one of them actually explicitly told you he was there in what sounded like good faith. I want to listen to a clip of him talking. His name is Luke Tagle.
I tend to hang out with conservatives. I think that's sometimes a problem because I don't want to live in a country in which everyone thinks exactly like I do. I like to live in a country with people that have different opinions than me.
So not exactly the sentiment one might guess one of these very passionate Turning Point folks would have.
I agree. And I was kind of expecting that if anyone from Turning Point came, there might be more drama of them just sort of like catcalling and heckling and whatnot. But no, I think the people I spoke to who were there were actually genuinely interested and wanted to participate in that debate.
What was going on stage? Was it like a show? Were people giving speeches the way they were at America Fest? What was happening exactly?
So the UnF America Tour had these folks who were on the left, obviously, and they were debating a series of predetermined topics with speakers who had been chosen from the Republican side of things. And this went on for a few hours. And then at the end, it was the, I would call it the Prove Me Wrong format, where there were two left-wing streamers on the stage. One of them's very famous. His name's Destiny. I had never heard of him because I'm old, but a lot of the people in the crowd who were more hip definitely knew who that was and were there for him specifically. So they had a microphone, and then anyone in the audience was welcome to come up and ask them to sort of debate or talk about a particular topic. So that was the last part of the show.
So Luke, for example, who explicitly said, I'm here because I'm interested in debate. What was your sense of how he and the other Turning Point folks who were there were reacting to all this? Were they participating? Did they seem like they were compelled by anything that was happening?
The sense I got was that everyone had a good time, and they did feel, when I asked them whether they think there's an opportunity, that there could be a turning point on the left. They don't agree that the UnF America tour is there yet, but they think that it's something that could happen, and it's something that they claim that they would welcome also, like on college campuses, for example, where many of these kids have schools, high schools or colleges with Turning Point chapters, but there's not really an equivalent. And they're like, we want to debate. And there's nothing on the other side. And that's kind of disappointing to us, actually.
This reminds me of something that you were speaking about in our conversation yesterday, which is how much of the appeal of Turning Point for a lot of these kids seems to be the creation of a space to come and talk things out. And I know that there are a lot of observers on the left of Turning Point who have their doubts about whether or not that is what is happening in earnest. But the conversations that you and I have both had with the students who are involved in Turning Point would seem to suggest, like, this is as much about belonging as it is about any particular set of ideas.
Yes.
So in the vein of Destiny, yes. Who neither of us were familiar with before the UnF America tour, when I had my conversation with Z, I asked her, do you feel like the left needs a Charlie Kirk, a charismatic figure like Charlie, to create this space that we were just talking about? And her answer was, quote, I don't think we need one because there isn't one on the right. Which I guess was a reference to the fact that Charlie Kirk has now passed away.
Yes, and Z and I actually had a somewhat parallel conversation, so that's funny that you say that.
Oh, interesting.
Because I was saying, who's the figurehead here, basically? Is it you? Because Z herself was not on the stage, was not one of the speakers, and says that she's not really a debater. But she did say, you know, there are some younger folks who have clout, who are more like symbols of the movement, including Destiny and a few others. But kind of said the same thing and is actually questioning herself what Turning Point is going to look like without Charlie Kirk, because it was a movement that was so formed around him.
Right. Well, This is a clip from a guy named Nathan Howell from Oklahoma. You were asking him, I believe, if he felt more aligned with Charlie Kirk or with Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. This is what he said.
I would say that I more align with Charlie Kirk simply because I believe that Charlie Kirk had a very strong faith, and that's something that's very important to me.
And just one more person in this vein. This is another guy named Charles Rasmussen.
I think Charlie Kirk, I feel like he was a bit more virtuous, and I believe that there's something to be said about having even basic virtues when being a political leader.
So these comments to me would suggest that the allegiance of at least these guys is very much with Kirk specifically and not necessarily even Turning Point or the Republican Party. Did you get the sense that they were compelled by any of the Destinies or the other folks with clout that were on hand at Marley's?
I know that Rasmussen was, because he told me so specifically that he was excited to talk to Destiny. And he's one of the people who actually went up to the mic and had a question. And the question was, what's so wrong about authoritarianism? And they talked about that for a while. And it was certainly an interesting conversation. Uh-huh. And so, yes, I do think that there's an appetite for that. And I agree about the Charlie Kirk being the central figure or idea that people were there for, both at America Fest and more broadly. I asked that question about who do you prefer, Kirk or Trump, to even more folks, and they all said the exact same thing, which is Kirk.
I think of Turning Point as an intense, originally far-right, almost fringe, extreme, very passionate group of people who sort of pulled the needle and shifted the middle of politics further to the right. So when I think of a Turning Point on the left, quote-unquote, I think of a group that's far left and talks about social issues, right? Abortion, for example, and tries to pull the needle and pull the political center further to the left by being on the extreme. And that is not what Z was talking about. And I think that's one of the fundamental differences I see between her organization and how Turning Point started out. And I don't know if that means they can't be successful. I think one of the other questions that I had for Z is, what does the Democratic Party, capital P, established party, think of what you're trying to do? And her answer was basically they've not been responsive and not been open to it, which I think is really interesting.
That is very interesting to me, because in my conversation with Z, the two politicians that she name-checked twice in the conversation as representing what she sees as the future for the Democratic Party are Gavin Newsom and Pete Buttigieg, who I would argue are fairly establishment Democratic figures. They have their controversies, but it's not like she said AOC.
Mamdani.
Right.
Bernie. Exactly. I really do believe that Turning Point makes people feel more like they have a purpose and that they are cared for and seen. And the Democrat message, I'm going to recite something someone told me, a random Democrat at the UNF America event. He said, the left is inundated with a sense of demoralization. It's sort of a doom and gloom, you know, everything's rough, but we'll get through it, rather than a, you really matter. And this is your purpose in life. And as a father and as a husband and as a person of God, you know, which is really more.
It's moralization.
Yes. And I think probably makes people feel a little bit more engaged. So I wonder if that's something that they can conquer.
Well, even the name UNF America is starting from a place of demoralization.
Yeah.
Well, lots more to watch here, and I'm sure we'll be talking much more about this. I've been speaking with KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez. Cameron, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. If you go to jail, you probably expect to spend a whole lot of time being told what to do, when to go to bed, when to wake up, when to eat, when to work. It is jail, after all.
But for a group of inmates at the Pinal County Adult Detention Center in Florence, they got the chance to run their pod themselves. And it was all filmed for Netflix.
The prison system, it's the Wild West in some aspects.
You're locked down 23 hours a day. They feel like animals.
The more you lock a pod down, the more tension and anxiety will exist. So if we want real change, we have to try something bold. We got a little experiment. We're going to open up the doors. We're going to step out and let you guys control your living environment. And you can start building the skills you need so you don't have to come back to my jail.
That's Pinal County Sheriff Ross Teeple in the trailer for season 2 of Netflix's Unlocked, which was filmed over 6 weeks in early 2025. just after the new sheriff took office.
Our co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with him more about what it was like to adopt this unconventional approach to corrections and if he thinks it led to any changes in his jail. He spent 12 years working as a correctional officer, where, as he described it, he learned verbal judo.
When you're in the jail, you don't have a firearm. You have yourself and your verbal judo to talk and communicate with the population inside there.
Verbal judo. I've not heard it described that way. I like that. tell us, you know, how does a jail environment like this usually run? Because this, I think it'll probably illuminate how different this experiment was. Like, are inmates pretty much locked down all the time in pods like this?
Yes, ma'am. And that was one of the big things I'm a little older. I started in corrections in 1996. We're now in 2026, and for the most part, we still do corrections the same way now as what we did back then. Hmm. And corrections is good. There are people that do truly bad things, and we need to lock them up and throw away the key. But the majority of the people that stay at a county jail, we're not talking a prison,
right?
As an example, the average length of stay for someone in the Pinal County Jail is 19 days.
Right.
So we have 19 days to effect change before this individual comes back and they're now your neighbor. They're now a member of your community. And I did not see the advantage of, if we only have someone for 19 days, locking them down, tell them when to get up, when to eat, when to go back to their cells, and when to do everything. And then they become what we call in corrections institutionalized.
Right.
They can't independently think for themselves. And then they go out to society and we find out maybe that's why they're reoffending, is because now they have to think for themselves. So that was the big thing with the experiment, was allowing them to make the correct choices. And that way, when they go back out and they're your neighbor and my neighbor, they are hopefully a better member of society.
Right. And there's this scene where you kind of present this experiment to these inmates in this pod. And what did you tell them? Like, how was this going to work from your point of view?
One of the things, and this is admittedly some of my bias with working with, because my experience was at the Arizona Department of Corrections. So they're all convicted felons doing hard time.
Right.
And so I carried a little bit of that bias in there. And so I wanted them to know, this is not a rewards program. This is a responsibility program. And I need you to tell me what realistically you need to make yourself a better person. One inmate in particular, he had never balanced a checkbook in his life.
Wow,
he had never been taught how to. He was a high school dropout and had never balanced a checkbook. Well, great. When he came to me with that, he's like, hey, this is going to sound stupid. And then when he told us, that's absolutely not stupid. That's a life skill that we can definitely get you trained up on.
Yeah. So, I mean, you had 6 weeks, 53 inmates, although I think they kind of cycled in and out, right? But you basically unlocked the doors in this certain pod and let the inmates figure out how to run things themselves. I mean, tell us, like, what happened initially? Was it hard before it got better?
Yes, and it was hard before it got better, and there were at least one time where it got hard again. Mm-hmm. But I'll let the viewers watch episode 6 to know what I'm talking about. One of the big things that when I saw that, yes, maybe we are affecting a change, is letting them decide when to go to bed. When we first started this experiment, the younger population, as you can imagine, wanted to stay up 24/7. Well, the older population and the working population, because there are inmates, when they're in jail, they can get a job like working in the laundry room.
Right.
They could be a porter. They could work in the kitchen preparing the food. Well, to feed breakfast in my jail, the kitchen workers have to get up at 3:30 in the morning.
Right.
That was the point where I thought, yep, we're going to learn some stuff from this, because it was them that said, we would actually like the light shut off from this time to this time so the people that have to get up early can get to, and that was a choice that they made.
Right. So the first kind of sign of hope for you. But there's quite a risk in this, right? Like in unlocking the doors and kind of only surveilling them by camera. Like, were you worried at points? Did you think maybe this isn't going to work?
Yes, ma'am. Yep.
What happened?
There's one particular incident. Some people don't have very good, they have anger impulse issues, I should say. And that's one of the things that you have to worry about. One of the things, I think they mentioned it in the first program, is Arizona, the inmates control themselves through fear and intimidation.
Hmm.
And that was one of the things that I had trepidation about, was if we lock this down and we give them, is that going to happen here? There was some flexing going on in the beginning, but it, we always had to keep that in the back of our minds, because ultimately the safety of my staff and the inmates, it takes priority over the experiment.
Yeah. So you mentioned that this was not your idea to do this show. You, you know, were already given this as you entered office last year from the Board of Supervisors in Pinal County. I wonder, you know, what you think of the idea of putting this on television. Like, do you hope it teaches people something about the way that a jail runs or the people who end up in it?
Yes, I just want it to be a more eye-opening experience for people, and knowledge is power. One of the things that I've actually already received a social media message from a person that reached out. I guess they've already watched two episodes, mm-hmm. and they said, now I understand what my son is going through. And that was, to me, I was like, okay, that point made right there, that it helped one person at least get knowledge of what their family member goes through.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me ask you lastly about kind of lessons learned, I guess, like after a career in law enforcement and as you're taking the helm in Pinal County now, I wonder, you know, will you take lessons from this kind of radical experiment going forward and change the way things are run in the jail?
Yes, ma'am. There were some things that were just not economically feasible for us to continue on the long term and still be fiscally responsible to the citizens of Pinal County. But there, I will tell you that many of the lessons that we learned with this experiment, we've continued on with. And one of our next steps is to expand it to the female pod. If someone wanted to drive by 971 Jason Lopez Circle and look at the construction fence that's around the front of my jail right now, they can see that this experience has provided us with the opportunity to now build a reentry center onto the front of the jail. And the state is funding it, and we're building a reentry center. One of the big things is when you arrest somebody, 19 days they're in our jail, and when they get released, this is pretty much any jail. When someone's arrested, they're usually not arrested on the best day of their lives. Yeah. They're usually not wearing the best clothing, and they're not prepared to go to jail. Under a normal circumstance, they get arrested, their personal property gets zipped up into a plastic, and they go to jail. And then when they get released, they get that property in the plastic, and they are released out into society.
Right.
When an inmate gets released, they have to go through the section that provides them with substance abuse knowledge and training and locations that they want. They might go to somewhere. Number one thing that people violate their probation on is not making their probation appointments. Well, did we check to see if this individual knows how to read so they can read where their probation office is?
Yeah.
So those are the types of resources we're giving them as they leave. If they've got body excrements on their clothes the night they're arrested, let's get them different clothing that's for them to walk out of the jail with.
Yeah. So quite a big change that sounds like that this program and this experiment that you conducted with Netflix here seems to have spurred.
Yes, ma'am.
All right, we'll leave it there. Sheriff Ross Teeple joining us from Pinal County. Thank you so much, Sheriff, for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thank you. You have a great day and a happy new year.
Well, it is officially New Year's resolution season. Gen Z producer Amber Victoria Singer has been reflecting on one of her 2025 resolutions.
Historically, my New Year's resolutions have not been very serious. In 2022, I vowed to watch and review 100 movies. In 2023, I wanted to drink an entire beer without grimacing. In 2024, I set out to learn how to play the drums. These were pretty easy goals. Last year, I was ready for a challenge. So, I made a huge lifestyle change. I gave up my ability to call an Uber, to read Yelp reviews, to mobile order coffee, and to check my email away from my computer. I got a dumb phone. I was 5 when the first iPhone came out. A smartphone has been practically glued to my palm for half of my life. By 2025, I'd become accustomed to narrating my days through near-constant posts on the app of the moment. Snapchat, Instagram, Twitter. Hours would go by in an instant. It's too much. I want to have time to pursue my hobbies, to read books and go on walks and play music without stopping to check who viewed my story or commented on my post. I started with some of the standard tips. At night, I plugged my phone into an outlet across the room rather than by my bedside table. I changed the screen colors to black and white. I set app time limits. I tried to exhibit a little more self-control. But after 6 months, nothing seemed to be making a difference. How unfair, I thought, that I never got the chance to exist in the world on my own without a tiny, powerful computer at my fingertips. Then it clicked. No one is forcing me to have a smartphone. In July, I started researching the experiences of people who switched to dumb phones, ranging from traditional flip phones to modified smartphones with limited apps. I noticed a lot of people in the dumb phone community were clamoring to get one specific device, the Lightphone 3. There is a long wait list to get one directly from the company that makes them. I'm impatient, so I found mine on eBay. I paid less than half of what a new iPhone costs. The Lightphone 3 is a small, thick, black box. My friends call it my brick. You can send texts and make calls, get directions, take photos, listen to music and podcasts, set alarms, and write notes. It also has a flashlight, a calendar, and a hotspot. The only thing it doesn't have is access to the internet, so no social media, Google, or email. Going from iPhone to Lightphone was not a smooth transition. My friends complained they couldn't track my location. Without Apple Pay, I had to get back into the habit of bringing my wallet and cash everywhere. For a while, I still reached for my phone whenever I had a thought I wanted to share on Instagram, and I felt like I was missing out on what others were sharing. But it's been worth it. My days feel longer. I canceled my Spotify subscription and figured out how to download CDs. I spend hours reading books instead of doom scrolling. I talk to my friends and family on the phone. I have no clue what my long-lost high school classmates are up to, which is okay. I won't be switching back anytime soon. In fact, I've resolved that this year, I'll be devoting some of my newfound free time to a classic January cliche, the gym membership I bought last week.
That was the show's Amber Victoria Singer.
Sam, are you a resolutions person?
I actually am. I would like to offer the patent-pending Dingman method, which I call small, medium, large. Small is you take something super practical, like I'm going to switch to black coffee. Medium is something longer term, like I would like to lose some weight. And large is like kind of a mindset reset. Mm. And what I find is that if you do it this way, the small can lead to the medium, which can lead to the large.
All right. I like the fact that you've put in for a patent, a trademark on this.
Yes.
That's smart.
Yeah. I'm waiting on a callback from the PTO. I haven't gotten anything yet. I don't know.
Yeah. I bet. Any day. All right. That'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday.